The Biden-Harris Agenda. What can the new administration accomplish? President Joe Biden wasted no time yesterday. Within a few hours of the inauguration, he signed 17 executive orders, undoing actions taken by President Trump. Those orders ranged from lifting the U.S. travel ban from mainly Muslim countries to revoking the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. He also signed a letter committing the U.S. to re-enter the Paris Climate Accord and halted construction of the border wall. What's next? What can the new administration do with or without Congress, especially in the midst of a pandemic and recession? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our guests, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post and Bowdoin College's Andrew Rudilevich, share their thoughts on the landscape facing the new administration. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We have a new president who faces a daunting set of crises. Today, we'll talk about what the Biden-Harris administration will tackle in its first days and the outlook for the nation. My guest, Karen Tumulty, a columnist covering national politics for The Washington Post, and Andrew Rudilevich, professor and chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. We welcome your comments, your questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Such a pleasure to have you both with us for this hour. Karen Tumulty, I'm going to start with you. What struck you yesterday? I know among the things you noticed was the words of the Republicans and Republican leadership.
I mean, what struck me was like how many images we saw that we'd never seen before, whether, you know, it was a field of 200,000 flags instead of an inaugural crowd, or somebody wiping down the lectern in between speakers, or, you know, a National Guardsman bowing their head in prayer during the invocation. But at the same time, there was this sense, as abnormal as it was, of a return to normalcy. And part of that was, you know, the fact that we had, all these ex-presidents there on the platform, kind words coming toward Biden from Roy Blunt and later Mitch McConnell. It was interesting, too, that McConnell and House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and even Vice President Pence chose to be at this inauguration and the ceremonies that went around it, rather than at the departure ceremony that President Trump was holding at Andrews Air Force Base.
Andy Rudilevich, what struck you?
Yeah, I think the direct efforts to restore some sense of visual normality. Now, obviously, with the outgoing president not there, and with, as Karen mentioned, you know, a field of flags rather than a field of people out on the Washington Mall, it wasn't ever going to be a completely normal inauguration, but the rhetoric, you know, was certainly a throwback to normal themes of unity and democracy, allusions to the Bible, you know, no American carnage in sight, except in the references, of course, to the effects of the pandemic. And so, you know, I do think, given Senator Blunt's comments, given the invitation to bipartisan congressional leadership to attend the inaugural mass before the ceremony, you know, there is definitely going to be an era of reaching out. On the other hand, obviously, a very sharp shift in a couple ways. One, we should mention the really important symbolism and substance of Senator Kamala Harris becoming Vice President Kamala Harris, right? The first female nationally elected figure, and of course, first woman of color in that position as well. And then the shift, you know, to a 50-50 Senate, meaning a democratically organized Senate, a few hours later, and a whole bunch of executive actions by new President Biden trying to both impress his own priorities, but also some of those priorities clearly are to reverse Trump-era policy.
Sure, and I want to talk about those executive actions in just a moment, but first I want to talk about just general priorities. And Karen Tumulty, President Biden does not have the luxury of choosing his priorities, does he?
Exactly. I mean, front and center is the COVID-19 pandemic and all the, personal and economic wreckage that has accompanied it. So that he takes office, with a sense of urgency that I think greater than anything we've seen. The closest historic parallel might have been FDR in 1932 during the Great Depression. I mean, he just has to get to work right away.
Andrew Rudolph-Levitch, you study, among other things, the way in which the president and Congress work together. Does this sense of urgency change the calculation, the who's in the R column and who's in the D column, do you believe, for the next few weeks at least, or next few months?
Well, there are a lot of battles, obviously, that are going to happen along partisan lines. One of the president's chief tools in persuasion is actually in the way that he, someday she, does agenda setting, right? And you did see an aggressive push already by President Biden, again, both on the executive action side, but also, with a large-scale immigration reform bill. He's also talked, of course, about almost a $2 trillion COVID relief bill following up the $900 billion bill just passed, and then an infrastructure package. So a lot of money coming down the pike, and we can talk a little bit more about the Senate procedures that might actually make it easier to pass money bills than anything else. But the burden, especially in a Senate that still requires 60 votes to move legislation through, is really going to be on the bargaining involved, right? At the moment, I don't believe they've even agreed on how to organize the Senate under the 50-50 split. So definitely some hurdles facing the Biden administration, but he is a creature of the legislature. He's been in Washington coming up on 50 years, amazingly. So, again, he's as well positioned as any president to make that work.
Let's talk a little bit about these executive orders, 17 of them. Karen, some of these orders, for example, actions on immigration and student debt, will be followed by larger legislation. For example, the president has made a move to protect the so-called Dreamers, but he wants comprehensive immigration reform. He's freezing certain student loan payments, but wants more relief for college students. Is there an appetite? Are there the numbers for Congress to give him what he wants?
Actually, no, not without a lot of negotiation. And I think that if there is a model for potential progress, it is what we saw in that $900 billion package in December that Andrew mentioned. I think what you're going to see, if there is to be any progress on any of this, is a coming together of Democrats and Republicans who are sort of more centrist than the rest of their party, and that they sort of work out from the center. Now, this is traditionally the way things get done in Congress. It's just that we haven't seen it done that way in a very long time. As for the executive orders, a lot of this was simply undoing things that Donald Trump had done with executive orders, which really do show that, as the old cliche goes, executive orders are written on water. They can be undone by the next president. But President Biden, a few days before Christmas, had a phone call with about a half dozen of us columnists, and I asked him about how far he really thought he could go with executive orders. And he is, I think, going to disappoint a lot of people on the left. I mean, he really believes, he said, "I've never been a fan of the imperial president. I really don't think that the executive power should be stretched." So, for instance, there was a sort of moratorium on student debt repayments. But what he did not do, which is what some people wanted him to do, what progressives wanted him to do, which is a massive, you know, $50,000 debt forgiveness. He just said, I do not, others will disagree. I do not think that is within my powers to do as a president with executive orders.
Well, Andrew, this is your area of expertise. Tell us, what is, give us a little bit of a primer. What is an executive order? What determines what is an executive order and what needs to be decided by legislation?
Yeah, well, that's a dangerous question to a professor, but I will do my best to keep it relatively straightforward. An executive order is just that. It's an order to the executive branch itself. So technically, an executive order is not addressing the public. A proclamation is used for that. It's also, you know, using the president's own powers as they have been delegated by the Constitution or in statute over time. So when the president, for example, wants a department to do something that is actually in that department's power, it's normally issued as a memorandum. So if you go onto the White House webpage, right, and look through, you'll see some of these things are executive orders formally, some are memoranda, there are proclamations, there's a letter to the World Health Organization, you know, saying we're coming back. So there's going to be a mix of executive actions. One of the things that's also separate are regulations, right? And those are issued by the departments. Those take longer to do. And if they're locked in through the normal process of public comment, they are harder to reverse, right? An executive order, Karen's absolutely right, can be reversed with the flip of a pen. And indeed, that's what happened yesterday to a whole bunch of President Trump's executive orders. They were simply revoked. Regulations are harder to do. And so some of what you saw yesterday was actually kind of a holding pattern with, you know, President Biden directing members of his cabinet to take a look at stuff. You know, you've got 30 days to report back on how to do this. One interesting combination of the two was an executive order that basically revoked many of President Trump's executive orders that governed how regulations were to be issued and the kinds of costs and benefits those regulations included. President Trump wanted to try to avoid imposing costs on business, for example, and not counting benefits that might be further down the temporal road health-wise, for example, with environmental legislation. So you do have a signal, at least, that the President Biden's willing to pursue more aggressive regulation, but that is going to take a while, right? That's not immediate. And really, you know, to shift environmental laws, which haven't been amended dramatically in 30 plus years, you know, to shift immigration law, to shift, you know, any of the areas where President Biden really wants to move the needle, he will need legislation. And of course, for money, he'll need legislation.
Karen Tumulty, how do you foresee the impeachment trial playing out? And will it interfere with Biden's other priorities?
There, too, I think the Biden people have made it clear. In fact, Ron Klain, the new White House chief of staff, has flat out said they believe that Congress can exercise what they say is its constitutional responsibility while addressing the urgent priorities, starting with this $1.9 trillion COVID rescue package. But they have also said they want this trial to be short. So, you know, I think there is a pretty good chance that it proceeds and proceeds pretty soon, but that I don't think it is going to last very long. And we are even hearing it could be as short as 3 days. Now, part of this is going to be, you know, how does Donald Trump and whoever he decides his legal team is respond to this? Do they want to call witnesses? Do they want to drag it out?
Andy Rudilevich, any thoughts on to add to what Karen Tumulty has said about what an impeachment trial might look like?
Yeah, well, it's certainly another burden on time, right? And time is a precious resource on the legislative calendar. So you've got the impeachment trial to deal with. You have President Biden's appointees, right? A couple thousand over, you know, ultimately appointees who need to be approved by the Senate. We've only seen, I think, one cabinet secretary or cabinet level appointment confirmed so far. So that takes time. And then, of course, you've got this, you know, pretty large scale legislative program as well. And so, yeah, to the degree the impeachment trial, you know, does drag on, and to the degree that it takes the space of other Senate business, that will just make it a little bit harder for, you know, the administration to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Karen Templeton, I want to ask you about the Republicans in Congress that are more moderate. What are some issues you think that they will work with President Biden on, and how quickly?
Well, I do think the urgency of this COVID package is going to be front and center. And, you know, it will be sort of the big tell. But I would also keep an eye on things that may look kind of esoteric and inside baseball-y to people outside of Congress. But they're very important to the culture of the place. And first and foremost right now is these negotiations that are going on between Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader and new de facto majority leader in the Senate, over how they are going to conduct themselves in a 50-50 Senate. And this gets down to negotiations over things like the last time this happened in the early 2000s, when the leaders were Tom Daschle and Trent Lott. They agreed that membership on committees, the chairman would be Democrats because they, you know, the chairman would be the Republicans, rather, because they, you know, had the power. But they also did things like split the membership, split the budgets, and things like that. Now, Mitch McConnell has thrown into these negotiations the question over whether the Senate will change its filibuster rules and whether they will, you know, not require 60 votes to do things outside of budgetary measures. I just think there's a whole trust building exercise going on here that is going to be very, very interesting to watch.
Sure. I know a lot of people really paying attention to what happens to the filibuster. Andy Rudilevich, explain to us why it matters so much.
Well, the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It's something that the Senate adopted over time. Basically, in the early 1800s, they removed from their rules the ability to cut off debate. And that was restored in the 20th century, but with a supermajority rule, so that originally needed, two-thirds of the Senate, and then now 60 votes of the Senate to stop debate on many issues. That's been whittled away, right? Judges, and notably the Supreme Court justices who were confirmed during President Trump's term, the filibuster was effectively ruled out of order for nominations, but it remains in place for normal legislation. And, you know, that, again, means that if you need to reach out and get 10 Republican votes for a particular piece of legislation, that's obviously going to shape the substance of that measure. Now, there are ways, there's a process called reconciliation, which allows for budget matters at least, a mere 51-vote majority. But in general, you know, with a divided Senate, you're going to have a lot of power normally in the middle, right? Not just on the Republican side, people like Senator Collins from Maine, of course, but also on the Democratic side, right? Every Democratic senator has a veto, prospectively, over the Biden administration's program. And so, you know, you're going to have to do a lot of coalition management and a lot of reaching out. That case in 2001 that Karen mentioned, right, that actually fell apart when Jim Jeffords, the senator from Vermont, who was a Republican, felt disrespected by the Bush administration and wound up becoming an independent, throwing control of the chamber to the Democrats. And obviously that's something the Democrats would hope to avoid.
All right. Well, we are talking about the new Biden administration with Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post and Andy Rudilevich from Bowdoin College. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from EcoMaine, reminding you to recycle because when you do, you're helping create new important everyday items, EcoMaine.org. And by Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud supporters of the voices of independent and in-depth journalism at Maine Public News.
Part of police officer Jeremy Brewer's job is delivering bad news.
As we sat together, she asked me one question: what am I supposed to tell my kids? I could feel she didn't want me to answer that question. She wanted me to connect to the depth of that experience she was going through.
Stories from speakers found through TED's Global Idea Search. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And you can hear the TED Radio Hour this evening at 10 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. There'll be a Maine CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw this afternoon at 2. The briefings are now on a Tuesday-Thursday schedule. Tune in to Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, or the Maine Public Facebook page at 2 this afternoon for the live update. The CDC briefings are also archived on our website for later on-demand viewing, and you can find the link on the television drop-down at MainePublic.org. Once again, the Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus will be today at 2 on Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and on Facebook.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the challenges that the Biden administration faces and how the executive and legislative branches may interact. Also, what might just happen in the next few months in Washington. Joining me, Andrew Rudalevich, professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Karen Tumulty, political columnist for The Washington Post. You can share your comments or questions about the new administration by email. talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Karen Tumulty, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the racial justice movement, and I'm wondering what you believe we can expect out of the Biden administration and out of Congress this year, if anything.
Well, I think that, the Biden administration has made a big statement here going in just with the sheer diversity of the president's picks for his top White House post, his cabinet. I think Kamala Harris is, given her own background, not just her ethnicity, but the fact that criminal justice issues are something she's been involved with for her whole career is going to be a big player on these questions as well. But I just think it's going to be a very different kind of Justice Department in particular than we have seen.
Andrew Rudalevich, I want to talk to you about the political parties, and we'll start with the Republicans. What do you see as the future of the Republican Party at this point?
Well, I think that's very much in flux. Members are trying to figure out exactly what the ongoing influence of now former President Trump is going to be, right? How will he seek to use, his still presumably potent influence over the base of the party out in the states, right, in potential primary challenges, right? You're seeing a split already. All right. Over, for example, the third ranking Republican in the House, Liz Cheney, voted to impeach the president. A very strong statement. Senator McConnell has made statements, pretty critical, especially by the standards of the last 4 years of President Trump and his role in the January 6th riot storming of the Capitol, leaving open the possibility he would vote to convict the former president in this impeachment trial. So you're seeing, sort of the some aspects of Republican leadership institutionally, right, the party in Congress, if you will, staking out a claim of sort of independence. But the question really does remain about the party in the electorate and, where are they going to go, right? Who's going to emerge, as a sort of new generation of leaders? Will there be an effort to beat, perceived anti-Trump Republicans in primaries that are going to start pretty soon, right? So there is not a long period of time for this to percolate. I think you're going to see, a number of lanes open, if you will, as different people begin to maneuver for influence within the Republican Party. And some of this will depend on, a decision to cooperate or not cooperate with the Biden administration, which is why I think it's interesting, a lot of what the Biden legislative priorities encompass are kind of low-hanging fruit in the sense of giving a lot of money to a lot of people in a lot of places, right, which is generally a good way to get legislative support, especially when we are still losing, 900,000 people filing for unemployment this week, right? The first administration to have a net loss in jobs, you know, since the Hoover administration. So clearly a lot of help needed out there, not least with vaccine distribution. And so, you know, I think those things are going to be easier to get. Immigration is an interesting first choice. It's a harder pull, just like criminal justice reform that Karen just mentioned. Those are not low-hanging fruit, I suspect.
Karen, what strikes me is Mitch McConnell's words are so different than when President Obama was elected, and he famously said something to the effect of his biggest goal was to make sure Obama was a one-term president, which of course didn't happen. You don't hear that language coming from Mitch McConnell today.
For a couple of reasons, one of which is that Joe Biden, at the age of 78, has not discouraged the idea that he intends to be a one-term president. Mm-hmm. And then there is also the fact that Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden have an actual personal relationship, a friendship that goes back a long time. And we did see, even during the Obama administration, that if somebody needed to cut a deal with Mitch McConnell, including things like going over the what they call the fiscal cliff, the guy they would send up to the Hill to do it was always Joe Biden. So there are a couple of things, I think, going on here.
All right. I'm going to go to Kim in Rockland, but after that, I want to talk about the future of the Democratic Party. Kim, hi. Go ahead.
Oh, cool.
Go ahead.
I feel like there's a weight lifted off my shoulders. Because of the new administration coming in.
Karen, Kim's sentiments are, he's not alone. She's not alone.
And I think that given the, you know, terrible public approval numbers that President Trump left office, I mean, I think that is a widespread feeling right now. He was practically uniquely unpopular president. But he has also left, and going back to Andrew's point about the future of the Republican Party and the efforts of Republicans to sort of the establishment to kind of wrest it back from Donald Trump, Trump has implanted in a not small proportion of this country's population this kind of hangover, this kind of corrosive idea that somehow, this false idea that somehow Joe Biden's election was not legitimate. And that is really what set off those deadly riots a couple of weeks ago. That is what kind of continues to fester in the kind of dark corners of the internet where you see all of these weird conspiracy theories. So I do think that overall, among Americans, that there is a sense of relief that the Trump era is over with. But there is this kind of undertow as well. And how this plays out in, first of all, as you know, as Andrew said, the politics within the Republican Party as it sort of sorts itself out, but also in the larger question of the diminished trust in our government and in our institutions, I think, is very worrisome.
Kim, thanks for your call. Andrew Rutilevich, returning to the future of the political parties, sure, the Democrats have a unified government right now, but it's by the slimmest of margins, a 50-50 split in the Senate, only a handful of seats separating the aisles in the House. And I know that within the Democratic Party, there is so much disagreement about how bold to be and how on everything from health care to immigration reform to racial justice. With such a close Congress, how much power do the far left Democrats have in setting the agenda going forward?
Well, potentially a fair bit, right, in terms of leverage, again, over the substance of bills that move forward. I mean, again, with a small single-digit margin in the House, any 5, 6, 7 members who want to band together and make demands are going to get a hearing at least. And certainly, you know, you saw back in the primary season, right, the sort of prehistoric, almost pre-pandemic era, you know, the Democrats basically came together to support Biden as electable, right, as the person who could beat Donald Trump. And that wasn't always popular among especially the left-leaning members of the party. But, you know, the gamble paid off, right? And we have President Biden in place. The question now is whether they want to stick to the terms of that bargain. What will they demand in response for their support back when? You know, it was, again, a much more coherent party in public in 2020 than it was in 2016. You'll remember the 2016 convention with, you know, Sanders delegates booing Hillary Clinton. You know, obviously the virtual convention kind of helped control that, but it was also, I think, a party that really was trying to show unity and understanding, right, that it needed you know, to defeat a president who was, you know, unpopular, but had, as Karen mentioned, this really strong base of support, right? President Trump got 46% of the vote in 2016. He got 47% of the vote in 2020. His popularity has been extraordinarily stable, albeit low, right? And, of course, trailed off towards the very end after January 6th. So in a way, right, Democrats now can tell themselves, oh, we could have beaten him easily. I don't think that's the case, right? It was a difficult win. I think, you know, they did gamble correctly on Joe Biden, but now, you know, again, you know, given the generational pressures in the party, given the ideological pressures, right, you've got a, you know, 80-year-old House leadership. You've got, you know, a lot of people who want to express authority within the party, and I think we are going to see that play out louder and louder as the term goes on.
I want to go to an email from Rick. This is for you, Karen. The Washington Post was publishing an updated number of lies or misleading statements by President Trump for at least 3.5 years, but I never saw a final count. One Washington Post column cited a number of over 30,000. Is there a final tragic count? This is from Rick.
Oh gosh, you know, I wish I had those numbers. They were going up so high and so fast. It was like, you know, it was almost like budget numbers now where you're like trillions. It was in the tens of thousands. And, you know, I think we saw a kind of evolution of people in my business too, that, you know, when Trump first took office, journalists were reluctant to brand things lies. I think that there was finally a healthy development. And what I assume is that, you know, having all of news organizations have set up these gigantic fact-checking organizations, those are not going to go away. And hopefully they are a way to sort of hold power accountable going forward and permanently.
An email here from RW. Which senators have some motivation to switch parties or become independent? Could we see a Senate with 5 or 6 independents? Is the Senate a path to create a third party? Andy Rudilevich.
Well, it's tricky because a third party, right, especially one that's organized on a national level, faces the you know, problem that American politics are organized geographically, and you have to, you know, be able to organize in many different places to get any kind of real representation across the country as a third party, right? And of course, the Electoral College is its own bar to that. Within the Senate, right, a lot of senators do have, you know, at least, some have motivations to talk about, you know, the possibility of switching parties, perhaps to gain leverage. You have places, for example, Lisa Murkowski has been discussed in Alaska. In an interview, she had expressed her dissatisfaction with the current state of a Trump-led party anyway. And, you know, ballot rules in Alaska are a little different than in other places, so she would not necessarily be disadvantaged by becoming an independent. But, you know, I think, you know, people have talked about Joe Manchin, but if Joe Manchin were going to become a Republican, he had plenty of better opportunities beforehand. You know, I think there are, you know, there are party loyalties. We saw, you know, Senator Collins here, you know, asked, you know, why she did not want to become an independent in a way freeing herself from the Trump administration. And she basically said, look, I grew up as a Republican. I have deep roots in that party. I want to return it to what it was. So, you know, I think it's going to be tricky to use this as much leverage But you never know. I mean, people are going to negotiate. They're going to bargain. And, you know, to the degree that you have a 50-50 Senate, as I said before, everybody has a veto and everybody has leverage.
Well, what would you like to see the Biden administration do? If you're in the audience right now, call and let us know what you want to see as priorities. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment on our Facebook page, send a tweet at Maine Calling, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from CEI, helping Maine small business owners navigate challenging times. Learn more at ceimaine.org. By Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, lemon and pesto butter, Atlantic salmon, and three other varieties found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. And by Maine Solar Solutions, helping empower homeowners and businesses with solar electric solutions for 8 years. MainSolarSolutions.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young.
We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue.
Joe Biden hits the ground running, issuing executive orders on COVID-19, racial equality, and climate change after his inauguration.
The first full day of the Biden presidency. That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. A thank you to Kevin from Belfast for donating his 2009 Nissan Cube to Maine Public. Do you have a uniquely shaped vehicle that's looking for a new home? Well, please consider donating it to Maine Public. It's easy and there's no cost to you. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details. Donated cars of all shapes and sizes make it possible for us to do more here at your local public radio station.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the start of a new administration. Our panelists, Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post and Andy Rudalevich with Bowdoin College. You can call 1-800-399-3566. Again, that phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post a comment on our Facebook page. What would you like to see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris do and do right away? We'll go to Lester from Eddington. Hi, Lester. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I would love to see the Biden administration label the white supremacist groups as terrorist organizations.
Karen Tumulty.
Well, I think that is something that is not unlikely to happen, especially since it was striking that that President Biden yesterday in his inaugural address called out white supremacy specifically. Andrew, I don't know, but I had never heard language like that before in an inaugural address. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, that was definitely more direct than you would expect. Often these are sort of clothed in, you know, vaguer calls to racial reconciliation.
Well, Lester, thank you so much for your call. Karen Tumulty, you mentioned the Attorney General nomination earlier and appointment. And I'm wondering about other members of Biden's cabinet and inner circle and what kind of signals other than obviously the makeup in terms of age and racial makeup that strikes you. I mean, does it strike you as a cabinet of moderates, and will they have power to undo some of what was done during the Trump administration?
I think that beyond the diversity, what is striking about this cabinet is how experienced they are in their subject areas. I mean, to the point where there has been even some mocking that these are all the retreads from the Obama and even going back to the Clinton administration. And the other thing, and this is especially true within the White House, how long so many of their ties go back to Joe Biden himself. He is surrounding himself with people he knows quite well. And he says that one of the reasons he has done this is that he's very concerned about what he describes as the landmines that might have been left behind by the Trump administration. And so, and you know, this transition process was a pretty rocky one. There was not a lot of the typical sharing of information. So, you know, as Biden himself put it, he said, I've been teased for having so many old hands. He says the old hands know where the old bodies are buried.
Andrew, thoughts on the cabinet?
Yeah, I mean, that's I would endorse all of that. I mean, again, you have sort of a literal retread in Tom Vilsack over in the Department of Agriculture, taking his old job back. A lot of folks, of course, moving up from, you know, moving up one slot higher, you know, in the Biden administration than they were before. Yeah, a lot of experience and a lot of attention to the sort of descriptive representation of the cabinet. But I would say, you know, one thing that's going to be important for the cabinet to accomplish is to sort of oversee, you know, the rebuilding of the federal government workforce, right, which has been, you know, sort of under attack for a lot of years. But, you know, generationally, again, is turning over. We're going to have to attract a lot of people to the public service. We need to, you know, think seriously about how to bring in good people, let them do good work, but also hold them accountable, right? There's, I think, a longer-term conversation there. And bringing in sort of a technocratic cabinet might help with that in terms of emphasizing that expertise is valued, you know, that science is going to have a seat at the table here with regards to decision-making. Now, science isn't always going to, you know, override the politics of a given decision, but it does need to be in the mix, and I think the cabinet selections emphasize that that will be the case.
We'll go to Johanna, I think. There we go. Calling from Poland. Hi, Johanna. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question for Professor Rudalevich. I'm wondering, given the even divide of Congress that we now have, what do you think the prospects are, if any, for D.C. or Puerto Rican statehood?
Yeah, that is an excellent question, and of course has implications beyond, you know, the immediate substance or, you know, dessert of those two places for statehood, because of course as you become a state, suddenly you get two senators, and that would have a pretty big impact on, you know, the Senate moving forward, which is one reason it's going to be a contentious issue. I would guess that it's not immediately on the table, though it's on sort of the list of demands, especially from the left. You know, I did notice that the D.C. taxation without representation license plate went back on the presidential limousine yesterday after having been removed under President Trump. So, you know, I think there's sympathy there. I do think it's a hard haul, and it's not one of these low-hanging issues that you might be able to get immediate bipartisan support for.
Sure. Karen Tumulty.
Yeah, I agree. This is one of those things that may come up again, but it's going to be, I think, pretty far down the road, and you know, not the kind of thing that is likely to come up in the middle of fighting over resources for COVID and things like that.
Johanna, thanks so much for your question. I'm going to go to Clayton, calling from Sangerville. Hi, Clayton. Go ahead.
I'd like to see the Biden administration maybe possibly include some Republicans on, maybe even in the cabinet, or at least the Democrat-led House and Senate, possibly assign some Republicans to some leadership committees. I don't know that that's ever been done, but I don't see why it wouldn't or couldn't be done, or why it wouldn't be a good idea to help unify, you know, the nation, for example.
Karen.
You know, we have seen recent presidents have, in fact, appointed members of the other party to their cabinets. And I agree. I think it is you know, a healthy thing. The way Congress works, however, it is sort of the two camps. You do see that sometimes, by the way, in state legislatures, that committee chairmanships sometimes are, you know, distributed between the two parties. But this is not going to happen in Congress. The closest thing you have is, you know, occasionally senators who call themselves independents will caucus with one party or the other, but that's about as close as you get.
Yeah, I was actually a little bit surprised that President Biden did not appoint a Republican, you know, to the cabinet in this first wave. You know, that has been something that, you know, President Obama did. President Bush appointed a Democrat to his first cabinet back in 2001. You know, President Clinton had done that with Bill Cohen, actually, for Maine, appointing him to be Secretary of Defense. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the argument would be that would be, you know, cheap symbolism. But hey, we're all about cheap symbolism in American politics, so I was a little surprised not to see that happen.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Cornish. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wanted to say that I think that what America would benefit the most from right at the current moment would be a complete about-face in the Donald Trump approach to immigration. I think both parties, if we could get to the – this is not low-hanging fruit. This would be high-hanging fruit to get enough people to agree that this is what we need to do. But I believe what we need to do is just say, there are no more borders, period. We will let anybody who wants to come into this country as an immigrant, whether it's for economic adventure or whether it's from persecution, we just say, look, as long as we tell them, look, here's the situation. You may have to live in tents that we will be happy to supply you at the beginning, but we will help you build affordable, decent housing.
John, thanks for your call. And Karen Tumulty, I'm guessing that this is not something that's likely to happen, that we'll be lucky to have any kind of immigration reform.
Correct. And, you know, although that philosophy, not quite that philosophy, but it was, you know, how Ronald Reagan viewed immigration, that, you know, one of the things that make our country great is that people from all over the world want to come here. And one of my own formative experiences in Washington was covering the long slog that got us to the 1986 immigration bill under Reagan, which provided just a massive amnesty program. And Ronald Reagan was happy to call it amnesty for immigrants who had come here illegally. It's really interesting. And even George W. Bush tried to, push forward a legalization program. It has been sort of striking to see how the Republican Party's stance on this issue has changed in really a relatively short time.
Yeah, the business wing of the Republican Party, right, is generally in favor of bringing in a workforce. That part of the party lost traction, certainly in, you know, President Trump's very populist appeal, you know, to border walls and the like in 2016 and well beyond. It is notable that, you know, President Biden's first batch of executive actions does include, you know, a cancellation of the national emergency that President Trump declared at the southern border a couple years ago. It does include, you know, a revocation of that travel ban proclamation and its successors, again, from early in the Trump administration. And it includes a sort of less high-profile order reversing some of the directives regarding the enforcement of immigration law. You know, President Trump obviously had sort of upped the severity of enforcement in a lot of places, and that has been reversed, at least, again, symbolically to start with. All this stuff has to get implemented, but symbolically by the Biden administration on day one. So it'll be interesting. I don't think they're going to pursue a literal open border policy, but I do think there will be more openness, certainly, to wider reform and even to, you know, amnesty, which has been a dirty word since Ronald Reagan.
Mm. John, thank you so much for your call. We're going to move to Portland and Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for taking my call. One thing I'd really like to see during the Biden administration is more work towards for-profit prisons. I think it's a really major issue that we need to work on. It's a billion-dollar industry. Kamala was asked this question during the vice presidential debates, but she couldn't really give a concrete answer as to what the future holds for this. And that's something I'd really like to see moving forward.
Thank you. Karen Tumulty, do you know what the administration's stance is and how large of a priority it is?
You know, I have to admit, I don't know that. And, you know, it is certainly not, I don't think it's something that is going to be on the front burner, given every crisis that we are facing at the moment. But certainly, you know, you do. But I mean, you just see these horrific stories that pop up, you know, it seems like all over the country.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is, you know, some Republican movement on the, you know, the so-called carceral state issue, and, you know, just the sheer number of resources that we spend as a country imprisoning people. There's an interesting book by a scientist at Johns Hopkins, Steve Tellis, a few years back, looking at how Republican elected officials, not just at the national level, sort of approach this. And so there may be some room within a broader look at criminal justice reform, policing, you know, the way the Justice Department operates generally, for that to be taken up. It's certainly a priority issue, again, on the left of the Democratic Party. And if there is some Republican support, you might be able to see compromise there.
All right, Barbara, thanks for your call. Meredith on Facebook writes, I would like to see the end to Citizens United and dark campaign money. Of course, this question comes in right at the end of the program. But Karen Tumulty, what is the chance of having significant campaign finance reform?
Well, since Citizens United is a question for the courts, I don't see much movement on that. But again, it's a situation of priorities at this point.
And is there a way, Andy Rudilevich, without, of course, as Karen mentioned, it was a Supreme Court decision, but are there other avenues to reach meaningful reform?
Well, so part of the question, the part the court talked about was basically First Amendment rights, right? Are donations to campaigns considered speech in a way that's protected by the First Amendment? And the courts have effectively said yes to that. And I think given the makeups of the Supreme Court now, it's unlikely they'll change their mind. But disclosure, right, the dark part of dark money, that's something you could address. You could require much more disclosure of donations, the identity of the funders of different ad campaigns and the like, and I think that would help.
Okay.
And especially technology makes it possible too to be disclosing that in real time, as opposed to the way it works in our current system, which is oftentimes we don't find out, even when we do find out who the donors are, we don't find out until after they've done their damage.
Right. A lot of it's buried in the tax code these days because, things have moved out of being literally PACs. When we talk about super PACs, they aren't PACs. They're tax-exempt organizations, and that gets reported, if at all, very late, as Karen suggested.
All right. Well, starting with something pretty complicated, ending with something pretty complicated. I appreciate both of you being on the program today. What a treat. Andy Rudilevich, professor and chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and Karen Tumulty, a columnist covering national politics for The Washington Post. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. This program will be rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.